Good morning, everybody. It's Friday with Jim here at Coast Community Radio, and I'm your host, Jim, believe it or not. Happy to have in the studio with us today Matt Van Ess, who's program director over at Columbia River Estuary Study Task Force, otherwise known as CREST. Matt, hey, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jim. Thanks for inviting me.
We're going to be talking about various kind of coastal issues, but first, kind of getting started, Matt, let's hear a little bit about Matt. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school?
Okay.
In 3 minutes or less.
3 minutes or less. I'll do my best. I actually grew up in Maryland. I grew up on a little farm out there on the eastern shore of Virginia near a place called Ocean City, Maryland.
Wow.
So it's sandwiched between the Chesapeake Bay on one side and the Atlantic Ocean on the other side. And it's not too dissimilar from here. Really, a lot of emphasis on farming and fishing is a base of the economy there. And just grew up oystering and fishing and, you know, spending a lot of time out in the water and out on the Chesapeake Bay estuary.
Mm-hmm.
So migrated out west here and ended up down at South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve doing some work for these guys, and went to the University of Oregon for my master's degree and wound up in Astoria. I've been here ever since.
You're a duck.
A duck, that's correct.
Well, you're in the right place. So you're working for CREST, and years ago I was on the CREST board, and I probably should disclose, Matt, just as far as journalistic integrity, that I am under contract at this time with CREST on some habitat restoration projects, but that's certainly not going to influence our discussion today.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about the history of CREST. How did it start and stuff like that?
Right. CREST is, you know, was established in 1974. So, you know, we've been around for a few decades, actually. And the emphasis at that point was really establishing a research about the estuary, about the Columbia River estuary, and establishing baseline conditions for the Columbia River. Up to that point, down here in the estuary, there really wasn't a lot of information about water quality, habitat, in an organized way. And there was something called the Columbia River Estuary Data Development Program. It was a big program at the beginning of CREST, where we went out and did a lot of research in the estuary and came up with a biological atlas, you know, that's
that
still used today.
Is that where you came up with the hot spots?
the hot spots?
Yeah. The hotspots of contamination.
The hotspots of contamination. That information was looked at, as well as hotspots of habitat. You know, where's what's special about this estuary? What habitat is valuable? What have we lost over time due to alterations of the estuary and alterations of the Columbia River? It was really that type of effort at the very beginning, and CREST has kind of migrated from that into a regional planning entity where we have, you know, we work with cities and port districts on both sides of the Columbia River in Pacific, Wakayakum, and Clatsop counties that are members of CREST, and we do projects on their behalf.
See if you can take us back in time, Matt, and what was the estuary like before the white man came here and started monkeying with it?
Right. It's hard to imagine. You know, Jim's been in my office, and I have these maps, beautiful maps up on the wall of coast and geodetic surveys, maps that were done in the 1800s. Really, these guys did such detailed surveys of the bathymetry of the estuary and also went out into these wetlands that really, you know, were up and down the river, the floodplains of the Columbia. Beautiful maps of, you can see the dendritic channels and the, you know, in these estuarine marshes that are just, you know, super highly productive places for you know, the ecology of the river. And the river was pretty wild in terms of, you know, big sandbars out in the mouth, and you can see that on those maps. You know, now we have a navigation channel that maintains the estuary.
But you're talking about a time before the dams?
Correct, right, before the dams, where we'd have these freshets in the early summer, June, July time frame that were really, you know, driven by snow melt in the upper parts of the watershed that would, you know, flood this habitat, this peripheral fringing floodplain habitat. And then, you know, those nutrients, the food and the, you know, the of the food web would enter into the estuary, and a lot of that has been lost over time due to dredging of the river, diking projects where we've, you know, reclaimed areas and created farms and things like that in formerly tidal wetlands.
Now, you know, part of our listenership is in Tillamook, which Tillamook Bay is a pretty productive estuary as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's also a national estuary program down in Tillamook Bay.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit.
It's just, that's a designation. We have that here in the Columbia as well, that it's an EPA, Environmental Protection Agency designation, mm-hmm. For really special places and, you know, recognizing the importance of the estuary in the, you know, ecology, but also, you know, the economy of the area too. A lot of our jobs here clearly based on, you know, fishing and, you know, no wetlands, no seafood. You know, that's 80% of the seafood caught in this country is dependent on estuaries at a certain time of their life cycle. So it's, you know, really important places like Willapa Bay, the Columbia, Nakanakum Estuary, Tillamook Estuary, incredible environments to work in and get a chance to, you know, live and play in as well.
Yeah, last week we had an oysterman here that raises oysters over on Willapa.
Right.
And sells them all by mail order, actually.
Wow.
Over a website. Now, the estuary, even though it's been kind of altered by man over the years, it's still very productive, but it's also the receptor of a whole lot of stuff coming down the river.
That's right.
How do we track that?
A good question, Jim. You know, it's called the mouth of the river here, the mouth of the Columbia, but it, you know, it really is the other end.
The other end. Yeah.
Everything's coming down at us. We do work with the port districts quite a bit, and in Warrenton and Astoria, dealing with maintenance dredging projects of their boat basins. And you know, we've discovered things in the course of those samples and sampling those projects where, you know, clearly this contamination is not coming from, you know, a boatyard. It's actually coming from, you know, upstream, mm-hmm. and coming down at us.
What kind of stuff, Matt?
There's definitely heavy metals out there associated with, you know, the boat building type of the paint and bottom paint and things like that. There's remnants of a DDT still in the estuary, and we discover that. And
wow.
That's clearly something that's not from you know, local sources. It's coming at us from downstream. That's one that stands out right now. Yeah.
And there's a cleanup effort on the Willamette. Do you know much about that?
In the Portland Harbor area?
Yeah.
A little bit about that. You know, major Superfund cleanup, major, you know, EPA funding to do that.
Matt has a question that's just been submitted to him.
I've just been panned a piece of paper that says, how much of a problem is the radioactive activity from Hanford in the estuary? And I have to say, I'm not an expert in that field at all. I don't really want to speak to that, Terry. I don't have a lot of information about that myself. But stuff's out there, for sure.
Is anybody measuring it?
Certainly at the sources at Hanford, you know, there's all kinds of monitoring and, you know, going on there. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So anyway, we find ourselves now in the modern age with the estuary somewhat compromised. And one of the things Crest does is to kind of help ameliorate those conditions.
Right.
Let's talk about some of the programs that Crest looks after in that regard.
Okay. I really am, I'm the habitat program manager at
yes.
Crest, and really what we're doing is we're out seeking for opportunities to restore the floodplain of the Columbia River in the estuary for to benefit juvenile salmon as they're migrating out the Columbia River. So these are projects that are less about spawning habitat for adult salmon, and they're more about the productivity, restoring the productivity and the habitat of the estuary as these animals are moving downstream. They're changing from freshwater animals to saltwater animals, and they actually spend time in the estuary rearing and growing. And you know, historically, we know that the juvenile salmon were in the Columbia River estuary year-round, rearing here. The different life histories of these fish.
Oh, the different species, you mean?
Correct, the different species, and you know, a lot of that diversity in their life cycles is lost. Where we have a juvenile salmon that migrate out pretty much from February into, you know, June, July timeframe is really the big time when the juvenile fish are migrating out the estuary.
Hmm.
And I guess I'd say too that it's really a sea change in the policy of the Columbia River and the endangered species recovery planning that's going on and actions. You know, I started at Crest in 1998. It was an era of, you know, channel deepening and issues that were really important and controversial to this community. And you know, I think everyone here did a really good job of highlighting this estuary matters. This is an important place for fish and wildlife. And, you know, historically, the funding to go and mitigate some of the impacts and recover these fish have been above the dams, above the hydropower system. So
right. They've
been tributary projects and barging fish and things like that. The estuary really wasn't a priority. Now it's a big priority.
Now, you mentioned programs that are determined. Where does Crest get direction? How do you... Who's your boss?
Who's our boss?
Yeah.
our boss is the our Crest Council.
Okay.
And so the Crest Council, we have regular meetings with the Crest Council, and it's a representative of each of our members. We have an elected official and a staff alternate that's from the Port of Astoria, City of Astoria, Clatsop County, as well as our partners.
So this is a public body?
Public body, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yep.
Who's on it?
Who's on the council themselves?
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, the chair of our council is the city planner of Astoria, Rosemary Johnson. She's the mm-hmm. staff person at the city that's designated Crest. Kurt Fritch is the city manager over at Warrenton. He's on the board. Chuck Beyer is a building official over in Wakayakum County. So we do have elected officials show up from time to time as well, but mostly it's the staff from the jurisdictions that we work with.
Now, you mentioned the city of Warrenton, which has a whole lot of wetlands. What kind of programs have you got going over in Warrenton?
In Warrenton, the type of services that we provided to Warrenton over the years are definitely wetland related, identifying wetlands and working with their comprehensive planning in terms of which wetlands are significant, which wetlands are less significant in terms of guiding development.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we're working with them on a marina improvement program where they're doing some designs in the marina there, and they're going to move some things around. We've helped with the mouth of the Skipanon dredging project this year, where the mouth of the Skipanon out there needed to be maintained. And so in order to do those dredging projects, you have to go out and sample the sediments, see what's in there, a lot of environmental compliance associated with that. And that's the type of services that typical Crest services that we provide.
Do you subcontract that sampling out, or you guys do it yourself?
We actually work with the ports and with the city. We have a corer, a VibraCorer, that can go down and take the samples,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll provide a boat for us to do that. And then the samples are sent to a lab for analyze for chemicals.
Sure.
Yeah.
And we've been talking a little bit about habitat restoration, but that's become kind of a main focus for you folks, hasn't it?
It sure has, Jim. Again, speaking about the ESA recovery and the four H's, you know, the habitat and hatcheries and harvest and hydropower.
Oh.
And, you know, the hydropower impacts to the Columbia and to these fish are pretty obvious, you know, in terms of blocking migration and... The spawning grounds in the main stem Columbia now are reservoirs. There's a biological opinion in 2008 that came out about the federal a hydropower system, mm-hmm. and it sets up requirements for these agencies. Army Corps of Engineers and Bonneville Power Administration are the two main action agencies in that biop, and they're required to restore habitat. So these estuary habitat projects are a little different than, you know, planting trees along a stream. Mm-hmm. These are major changes to the landscape where we're actually, you know, realigning levees and flooding the landscape. So they're pretty difficult projects to pull off. And Bonneville Power specifically has reached out to groups like the Columbia Land Trust, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, CREST, and some others, because we have a track record of being able to work with communities, work with partners, and implement habitat restoration projects. So there's a requirement to implement estuary restoration. CREST has experience doing that, and we're certainly taking advantage of that opportunity, Jim, and some of the projects you're helping us out with
as
well. Yeah,
and we'll talk about that a little bit further, but at this time, I need to remind listeners that we're listening to Coast Community Radio here in Astoria and Tillamook, and this is the Friday show, and I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, and we're visiting with Matt Van Ess from the Columbia River Estuary Study Task Force, otherwise known as CREST. Now, Matt, we talked about habitat restoration. I was wondering whether you could kind of walk us through a habitat restoration. In other words, you see a habitat that's been altered. How do you go about restoring it?
Right. Good question. Maybe some folks have seen some of our projects out at Fort Clatsop. It's a good example of what we've done here in recent years. A project at Otter Point, and there's another site called Colwort Creek. And the park was a really important partner for us, and their interest is really, you know, restoring the historical landscape of Lewis and Clark as they discovered it. Hmm. And, you know, they discovered wetlands when they went up, paddled up the Lewis and Clark River, a quagmire of bogs, and you don't experience that today because those wetlands, again, have been, levees are built around those wetlands, and there's cows and farms and houses and people there.
Mm-hmm.
So... You know, that's one project that we identified with the Park Service together, an opportunity to restore the historic landscape more to those types of conditions, but also provide habitat for juvenile salmon. So we're looking for places that are low in the floodplain that are, influenced by the tide.
So you need
on a regular
certain
basis.
Elevation to work with.
Correct. And there's all types of tools available to us, aerial photography, interpretation. There's also a LIDAR, which is a data set that comes from lasers, and it tells you elevations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really important data set to us. Then we can use modeling tools, hydrologic modeling tools, and actually, create a surface and a model and flood water over the surface to sort of predict what's going to happen when the levees are breached and the tides returned. So, we use these tools, and we also use, boats and kayaks and, get out on the ground, get our boots wet, assess the existing conditions of the habitat, and we hire third-party engineering firms to help us design these projects, provide an engineering stamp for the projects, and we'll go through an extensive design and analysis process where we'll, evaluate a range of alternatives, work with our partners, come up with a solution we think for what's best for the land, and then we'll go out and get the compliance the permits, which are pretty extensive, and it's not an easy thing to do because we're dealing with endangered species, and then eventually we'll hire a contractor, and we'll start moving some dirt.
But before we start moving the dirt, back up just a minute.
Okay.
Because I know the permitting process is a major function of CREST.
Right.
And Sam Giese and Madeline Dalton in your office
right.
Handle a lot of that.
Right.
Kind of what's involved in getting the permits? How many of them are there? What kind of agencies
okay.
are you dealing with?
Well, the work is in the water. It's in wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
And so because we're impacting wetlands in any way, we get permits from the Division of State Lands, Department of State Lands, DSL, Oregon DSL. It's a removal fill permit.
Mm-hmm.
We also get a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers Section 404 of the Clean Water Act that requires a permit from the Army Corps if you're filling or altering a wetland in any way. And associated with those permits, we get an Endangered Species Act consultation because, you know, we're dealing with juvenile fish that are in the water, and there's actually work windows for when you're allowed to do this work,
right,
to avoid times when those fish are in the water. That's a common best management practice for our projects.
Some of those fish are endangered?
There's 12 or 13 different specific runs of fish that migrate through our estuary here that are
salmon,
exactly.
Yeah.
So since it's a federal permit, the Corps Clean Water Act permit, you know, it triggers a lot of other federal permits. We also get a permit from Department of Environmental Quality, a stormwater permit from DEQ, and we also get a permit from SHPO, the State Historic Preservation Office, that's around cultural resources and, you know, areas that we're working in. So we do have some historic structures. The levees themselves are old enough where they're considered historic. And, at times we've had to provide archaeological monitoring for projects that's required through that permitting when we're in a place that's, culturally sensitive.
Right. That sounds pretty complex,
mm-hmm.
but how long, let's say you isolate a project that you want to do, a restoration project, how long does it take you to work your way through those?
Exactly. Good question. It's about a year to 2 year process to take a project from sort of handshake to ribbon cutting, where we're actually, working with a landowner, identified the project, then we're going to design it, fundraise, get all the grant writing lined up to be able to fund the project in the first place, do the compliance, and then actually get out on the ground and do the construction. It's about a year or 2 year process for each project.
Right. So once you get through that, then you're about ready to get out on the ground and do something. What do you actually do?
Right. So some of the projects, again, those projects out at the fort, Fort Clatsop, associated with a National Park Service, the first thing we did at the Otter Point project, for example, is we go into these wetlands, and these wetlands were altered. They were filled with dredge material from the Lewis and Clark River. So the wetlands are a little high in the floodplain.
Mm-hmm.
We actually did some marsh plain lowering, a lot of earthwork associated with that, where we're actually, excavating that material out and lowering the marsh plain, restoring and creating tidal channels in these places, putting large wood debris along the tidal channels. And then some of the work is also involved, as you know, Jim, where we're having to we're altering these levee systems where we're wanting to restore the floodplain, but we also have to provide flood protection for the neighbors. If we breach the levee at Otter Point, a requirement for that project was we'd need to build a cross levee. And that's a very extensive oversight by the Army Corps of Engineers to make sure that, we're building those levees up to core standards and in the correct way.
So do they actually come out and inspect and watch the?
They sure do.
Yeah.
And we have geotechnical engineers on site that we hire to make sure that our the way we're building, the methods we're building, the type of material we're using is all going to be up to post-Hurricane Katrina U.S. Army Corps of Engineers levee standards.
The one that I'm thinking of that I saw here last year was the work you did over on Liberty Lane.
Oh, okay, right.
Which is the road that goes down to Mertz.
Yep.
And there was a levee put through there, I imagine, during the Second World War that cut off 7 or 8 acres of wetlands. And so Crest took it upon themselves, among others, to open that up.
Right.
I got a chance to watch that happen. And what was amazing to me, Matt, is that within a couple of days of opening that up so that fish could go through it, there were fish going through it.
There were fish there, right, exactly.
Now, are those fish, are they kind of hanging around? They know something's going to happen, or what?
Well, they're pretty amazing animals, actually, and they're in the water column, and they're seeking out habitat. They're seeking out food. They're seeking out places to rear and hide. And, you know, we've seen that every time, Jim, you know, the first tidal cycle that we can get into this land for 100 years.
Right.
The biology in the estuary, this water is alive, you know, and the animals are right there. That Liberty Lane project was a good example. It's on the way down to the Mertz campus.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, you know, big 10-foot culvert through that road now. And that floods that little wetland back there. Fort Columbia is another good example. On your drive to Awaka, when you go through the Fort Columbia Tunnel, there was an undersized culvert there and a 100-acre wetland that was restricted from tidal influence, and now there's a 12-foot culvert through the road there.
Yeah.
And Crest did that project with the Washington State Department of Transportation.
Yeah, and a lot of these culverts were put in before people really understood these imperatives regarding the salmon, and so they were put in without any thought to salmon. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. You know, we're learning things. You know, we're learning things all the time. And you know, at one point was take all the wood out of the stream, mm-hmm. so the fish could get up there. You know, the wood's blocking them. You know, so a lot of projects went through, and you know, in the earlier days of salmon recovery, and they were actually removing wood from streams.
How long ago was that, Matt?
In the, you know, 70s, Jim. Oh. That was a common practice. Now we're putting the wood back in the back in the stream. So, but there's lots of opportunity in the Columbia. You know, in the lower part of the estuary here, something like, you know, almost 70% of the tidal habitat that was available to these fish has been lost. And so there are lots of opportunities to go out and seek these projects out. We're working up in the Portland area as well. We're working on a project in a Vancouver region and at Solvay Island. We're working on some projects. We have a couple people that work for us now in Portland. There's 15 of us at Crest. You mentioned Sam and Madeline,
mm-hmm.
and I'll just give some recognition to the people that we work with. These people are all top-notch experts in their fields. And really nice people to work with, as you know, Jim. It's really fun work, and it is inspiring to see that tide come in for the first time in 100 years and, you know, get a chance to experience that.
Yeah, we're kind of running out of time. But one project that's coming up around here that I just had a chance to look at, with Madeline a few days ago, is the removal of the 8th Street Dam on the Skipanon River. And I understand that the intent there is to open up the Skipanon again to have it function as a salmon stream.
Correct. If you guys know that geography over there in Warrenton, this is a big dam and tide gate system that was installed in the lower portion of the river, you know, at 8th Street in downtown Warrenton.
As a flood control structure.
As a flood control structure,
yeah.
Right. It was done in the 60s, and you know, now we're finding out that the structure really didn't provide a lot of flood control. And in fact, maybe it made flooding worse there, because it holds back the tides on these runout tides. The structure actually holds water back.
But there was no provision for fish passage there. Is that correct?
That's correct. It doesn't meet current fish passage standards. And you know, the idea, again, working with the city of Warrenton, the Skipanon Water Control District, the Skipanon Watershed Council, and Crest, trying to come up with a solution where we can alter that dam, remove that dam in a way where we're going to provide access still for the city of Warrenton,
mm-hmm.
but correct the fish passage problem. And there's like 11 miles of tidal influence up above there that's currently restricted.
Do you get input on that specific project from the Columbia Lake Homeowners Association?
That's the Skipanon Water Control District is actually the governing body of those structures, and there's a fish ladder at the Cullaby Lake that we're looking at that as well for fish passage. But that fish ladder at Cullaby Lake does two things: it provides fish access up, but it also maintains the water levels in Cullaby Lake. We're not going to change that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.